From NPR News in Berlin, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Rob Schmitz. This hour, the Trump administration says Europe faces civilizational erasure. How is Europe reacting? Also, a new biography of Dolly Parton tracks her rags-to-riches journey beginning in her Tennessee mountain home. And Christmas time in the Alps means St. Nick gets a little help from his monstrous, hairy, horned friends.
When the winter comes, you have the feeling, yeah, to act like a Krampus.
And that means punishing boys and girls who've been naughty, including me. Stay tuned to hear the Christmas carnage. First, the news. It's Saturday, December 13th, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Health has suspended and revoked the license for the Brainerd Assisted Living Facility Carefree Living. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the health department has conducted numerous investigations into the facility and found it was not in compliance with several state regulations and laws. These include neglect of residents, improper or lack of documentation for medications, procedures, and more, and not following through on correction orders. Brainerd Carefree Living is owned and operated by Oxford Living, a division of Spectrum Health Companies, which has 10 other Carefree Living facilities in Minnesota. The dispatch's attempts to reach company officials for comments were unsuccessful. The suspension is in effect immediately, but the facility is required to ensure residents receive necessary care until they are safely transferred elsewhere. The health department notes Brainerd Carefree Living can appeal the temporary suspension. The Nisswa City Council is taking steps to possibly seek a vote of no confidence or censure its mayor. The Echo Journal reports Mayor Jennifer Carnahan did not attend a special council meeting Wednesday that was specifically called to discuss her conduct. Carnahan has accused a Nisswa resident of assaulting her outside the Pickle Factory, the city's municipal bar, during the City of Lights event in late November. Prosecutors have declined to bring charges against the resident twice. Before the incident, the resident had raised concerns about Carnahan making disparaging comments about City Councilmember Jesse Zahn loudly in public. Councilmember Bruce London said the incident was the latest in what he described as a year of drama and conflict. In that year, the city has lost its administrator and clerk, and two interim administrators left within a matter of weeks. Carnahan was elected mayor in 2024. She is the former chair of the Minnesota Republican Party, where she was similarly accused of creating a toxic workplace environment. Months into her stint as Nisswa mayor, she also ran for the open seat in the Minnesota Senate created by Justin Eichhorn's resignation. Carnahan issued a statement following the meeting describing it as political theater and saying she would not be bullied into resigning. She says, quote, "No evidence of wrongdoing was presented, no specific code violations were identified before the meeting was called, and no due process was offered." The council intends to continue its discussion at its meeting on Tuesday. Minnesota students reported being less depressed in 2025 than in recent years, but a majority still say they'd recently felt anxious and on edge. This is according to the Minnesota Student Survey released Tuesday by the Minnesota Department of Education and other state agencies. The optional survey is administered to 5th, 8th, 9th, and 11th graders every 3 years in public school districts and charter schools. The Minnesota Reformer reports students also reported stronger connections to their schools and other improvements in overall well-being. The findings offer some hope that the decades-long decline of teen mental health, particularly acute during the pandemic, could be turning around. Students have also stopped vaping so much. Less than 8% of juniors this year reported vaping in the 30 days before taking the survey, compared to about a quarter of them in 2019. The survey's accuracy may be limited, however. Less than half of Minnesota students completed it, and the survey has become divisive in recent years for asking students about their drug use, sexual activity, and gender orientation. Some school districts have chosen to opt out altogether. A new study from the University of Minnesota has found that several species of parasitic fungi were effective at killing emerald ash borer beetles. The beetles are one of the most devastating forest pests to ever hit North America. The tool is called the auto-dissemination device, which traps beetles and coats them with spores of insect-killing fungi. Once covered in spores, the beetles can fly out of the trap and spread spores to one another through mating. Decades of research have gone into developing ways to control emerald ash borer. Ash trees are important in urban areas where they can comprise up to 20% of the urban forest, but they are also a dominant tree in the state's northern marshlands. The university says tools like this one are needed to protect ash trees in these remote areas where other forms of management are less feasible. The researchers are now testing the four most successful fungal strains in devices placed at sites across state parks and forests. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz, filling in for Scott Simon. The war in Ukraine is exposing the growing divisions between the U.S. and Europe. President Trump appears to be increasingly frustrated by his failure to end the conflict. Here's what he had to say about some traditional allies during an interview with Politico earlier this week.
Most European nations, they're decaying. They're decaying.
To get the European perspective on the state of transatlantic relations, we're joined now by Natalie Tacci in Rome. She's professor of practice at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Thanks for being with us, Natalie.
Great being with you.
So let's start with Ukraine. We're seeing reports that U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff will meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders here where I am in Berlin this weekend. We've seen a flurry of diplomatic activity in recent days. What do you think are the chances of any deal?
Frankly speaking, extremely low. And extremely low because there seems to be no intention whatsoever on Moscow's side to actually see this war come to an end. I actually think that the continuation of this war has become essentially fundamental to the survival of the continuation of the Russian regime. And as far as the U.S. is concerned, there obviously seem to be very little incentive, it seems, to exert any pressure on Russia. And on the Ukrainian side, although, of course, there is quite a lot of leverage that the U.S. has on Ukraine, it's not as high as it used to be. And this is essentially right. Because the U.S. doesn't provide military support to Ukraine anymore, certainly not as much as it did. And so basically, Ukrainians rely on the Europeans mainly, and Europeans continue to stand by Ukraine.
And meanwhile, President Trump has not been shy about criticizing Europe. Last week, his administration released its national security strategy, and it marks a very different approach to Europe for the U.S. I took a few notes. According to President Trump, European leaders are, quote, weak, and the European Union, he says, was established to, quote, screw the United States. How do you see these statements?
Well, essentially, if you take not just the national security strategy, if you take the statements made by Vice President Vance back at the Munich Security Conference, if you look at the actions of this second Trump administration, it actually paints quite a coherent vision. And the vision is one that I would describe as imperial collusion. There seems to be an interest in having good relations with Moscow, to an extent with Beijing as well. So in a sense, great powers that understand themselves as empires. And Europe is kind of inconveniently there, whereby if it stands united, it has a voice. If it stands disunited and fragmented, well, then it ends up on the colonial menu. And I think making Europe part of that colonial menu seems to be part of the intention.
Yeah, I mean, another highlight from that Trump document is that it claims Europe is facing what it calls, quote, civilization erasure. As you know from living in Italy, one of the biggest issues fueling the rise of nationalist parties in Europe is immigration. Why do you think the Trump administration is so interested in this issue on European soil?
Okay, so, of course, you know, one reading of it is, you know, Trump has an idea, or rather his administration have an idea of we, the white and Christian West. I mean, that's one reading of it. But I think, frankly speaking, scratching the surface, it's obvious that, so take, for example, my country. My country is led by a far-right leader that President Trump seems to like quite a bit. Right. Actually, Italy has seen, over the last 3 years with this government, an increase, a steady increase of migration flows because the government actually knows that there are labor shortages. There are other governments in Europe, let's take the Social Democratic Danish government, that has actually been far more restrictive on migration. Now, that doesn't seem to be one of the favorite governments of this administration. So I think, frankly speaking, the underlying, this whole sort of cultural, you know, sort of embedding of a worldview, there is actually, I think, the deeper sense that by supporting far-right governments in Europe, which tend to be, well, in fact, which are Eurosceptic, you get to a weak and divided and fragmented and disintegrated EU, which is in the interest of a Trump administration that sees the European Union as you were saying, quote unquote, screwing the United States.
That's Natalie Tacci of Johns Hopkins University. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The U.S. Justice Department is an institution in turmoil. This year, federal prosecutors have followed the president's lead to pursue criminal charges against some of his most vocal critics.
This is not about me. No. Yes. This is about all of us. Yeah. And about a justice system which has been weaponized.
My heart is broken for the Department of Justice, but I have great confidence in the federal judicial system, and I'm innocent.
That was, of course, former FBI Director James Comey, preceded by New York Attorney General Letitia James. NPR's Carrie Johnson has been covering the Justice Department for nearly two decades, and she joins us now.
Oh, happy to do it.
Now, Carrie, in your reporting since President Trump took office this year, you've talked about the brain drain at the DOJ. Give us a sense of the scale of that.
More than 5,000 workers have left the Justice Department this year by some estimates. That includes the acting director of the FBI and many of the other top FBI officials. At the Justice Department, the pardon attorney is gone. The ethics advisor is gone. Most of the prosecutors who took on public corruption are gone, as well as people who worked on cases involving the Capitol riot nearly 5 years ago. And at the Civil Rights Division, nearly 3 out of 4 lawyers are gone.
Wow. And how is all of that turnover impacting the work of the Justice Department?
The first thing to say is that there have been a lot of mistakes, misstatements of law, like in a big Texas redistricting case. A Trump-appointed judge says the DOJ civil rights letter in that case contains so many factual, legal, and typographical errors that even lawyers working for the Texas Attorney General, allies of President Trump, called the letter legally unsound, ham-fisted, and a mess. Then there are these alleged misrepresentations to courts in deportation cases. In D.C., Judge Jeb Boasberg is demanding to hear from the Justice Department about whether lawyers intentionally flouted his order this year to turn planes around carrying Venezuelan migrants. Erez Ruveni spent 15 years at the DOJ. He later blew the whistle on what he saw as misconduct in immigration cases. Here's what he told me this year.
The political leadership in charge of the DOJ didn't care one bit about our oaths to the courts. They had one and only one goal, put those people on planes, get them out of the country ASAP.
The attorney general has called Ruveni a disgruntled employee and a leaker.
So, Carrie, what is the cost of all of this turmoil?
People who have worked at the DOJ and the FBI really worry it's making the country less safe. The former acting director of the FBI and two other top officials there say they were fired for improper political reasons this year. Chris Maddy's a lawyer for some of those fired officials.
When you kneecap an organization by getting rid of its leaders, you really compromise the FBI's ability to carry out its mission.
Then another bunch of FBI agents who had nearly 200 years of experience got fired for taking a knee during racial justice protests 5 years ago.
So, Carrie, the Supreme Court said in an immunity case last year that a president has absolute control over the Justice Department. How is President Trump using some of that newfound authority?
President Trump has been pretty clear about his intentions. He's been angry ever since the Biden DOJ charged him with federal crimes in cases that wound up being dropped after the election. Here's Trump delivering a major speech at the Justice Department headquarters in March.
Our predecessors turned this Department of Justice into the Department of Injustice, but I stand before you today to declare that those days are over and they are never going to come back. They're never coming back.
There's now a pattern of the Justice Department going out of its way to help allies of the president and other people accused of political corruption. For instance, the president has granted clemency to several members of Congress, George Santos of New York, Henry Cuellar of Texas, among them. He's also issued pardons of the former president of Honduras and other convicted drug kingpins. That undid a lot of work by federal prosecutors and agents. And at the same time, the Justice Department seems to be targeting Trump's political opponents, people like the former FBI Director Jim Comey, New York Attorney General Tish James, and California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff.
So, Carrie, there's just so much to cover here. What are you going to be following in the weeks to come?
The Senate still has advise and consent power and some oversight power if the Republicans in charge now want to use that power. And there are some signs of infighting between DOJ leaders and the people at the top of the FBI. FBI Director Kash Patel, his deputy Dan Bongino, that could produce some turnover in the coming weeks or months. And some nonprofit groups suggest accountability for now, maybe simply documenting all the unusual and possibly unlawful things happening at the Justice Department.
That is NPR's Carrie Johnson, busy as ever. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to NPR News.
It's the people of northern Minnesota that power KAXE.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXE, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KAXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
It is 8:19. You're listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. You can join KAXE, KBXE, and Sundown Records for the Sundown Sessions, a young musician showcase next Saturday, December 20th, 3 to 6 at Sundown Records at 317 Beltrami Avenue in Bemidji. The acts include Liam Larson playing solo blues, bluegrass from No Rest for the Pickers, punk rock from the Rotten Sardines, and indie rock from Blackfish Blue. The event is free and all ages are welcome. Northern Lights Nordic Ski Club has their annual cross-country ski swap this Tuesday at Ardent Bicycles in Grand Rapids from 3 to 6. If you have gear to sell or donate, you may drop it off on Monday from 3 to 6 or after 9 on Tuesday morning. Ski Club members will assist with fittings and provide information on area trails. Let us know what's going on in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Here's more from Weekend Edition.
And from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Many Americans are struggling to pay their bills, and so are many American companies. This year, corporate bankruptcies have surged and are on pace to hit a 15-year high. Well-known companies like Spirit Airlines and the retailer Claire's are among the casualties. Edward Altman is professor at New York University and specializes in corporate bankruptcy. He joins me now from New York. Good morning, Edward.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Why are so many companies going bankrupt right now?
Actually, it's a combination of things. Going back to the days of COVID, interest rates fell dramatically due to the central banks lowering the interest rates so that companies could access capital and survive during lockdowns. And companies took out loans, paying those loans based on what's called a floating rate basis. That implies that as interest rates changes up or down, the cost to the companies change in the same way. So there was a big buildup in debt at very low interest rates. And this continued for several years through 2022. Subsequent to that, interest rates started rising in 2023, 24, 25. And so as a result, companies which were able to survive under very low interest rates no longer could withstand those higher interest rates across many different sectors.
Yeah, so it sounds from what you're saying is that a lot of this actually is sort of a hangover from the pandemic and the economic impact of that.
I'd say that's definitely a significant part of it. But the other part is the tariff situations, and particularly it's hitting small and medium-sized firms across the country. Farmers, for example, have had a record amount of bankruptcies as well. And the reason for that is these companies generally operate at very vulnerable margins. Their costs are being increased without them being able to increase the demand and pass it along to customers.
What sectors are we seeing that have higher rates of bankruptcy right now?
Leading the pack, so to speak, real estate companies. And these are companies that, again, borrowed very highly at low interest rates. Plus, they have large vacancy rates, particularly commercial real estate. For example, San Diego downtown has a vacancy rate of about 35%. Following that, healthcare and medical companies. After that, we have construction supplies, because that's tied to real estate. And then the usual characters, so to speak, that fail as the economy becomes softer are restaurants and retail. So I'm not surprised we are having such large numbers of bankruptcies. But I was struck by the fact that it started going up dramatically when the economy was posting pretty large and positive GDP numbers.
Now, as you mentioned, the U.S. economy, as measured by GDP, is on track to grow this year, yet we're seeing record numbers of corporate bankruptcies. Help make sense of that for us.
The economy may seem so strong in terms of very large companies, technology companies doing so well, bolstering the economy. But most of the economy, small and medium-sized companies in particular, are suffering dramatically. It's a soft underbelly in the economy in certain sectors.
How is this going to impact the labor market?
I find that the credit cycle tends to lead the business cycle. In other words, if you have a big increase in defaults, and there are various measures of defaults, but bankruptcies is certainly one of them, then it usually is between 1.5 and 3 years later that the economy begins to suffer. It's an indication of softness in the economy that doesn't show up in the GDP numbers, especially if those GDP numbers are impacted dramatically by very large, very solvent companies. You know, NVIDIA is not going bankrupt. Other companies in AI and infrastructure and data centers, et cetera, booming. But they don't provide as many jobs as you would think. So I'm worried about the softness of the labor market and the employment in our country.
That's Edward Altman. He's a professor at New York University. Edward, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so you've got your year-end best of list, best movies, best TV, the families huddled on the couch ready to binge. But amidst all the must-watch shows and films, there are some not-so-great options. Later today on All Things Considered, hear from podcaster and cultural critic Joanna Robinson of The Ringer about what not to watch this holiday season. Tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. In 1959, a skinny 13-year-old girl stepped off a bus in Lake Charles, Louisiana, after a 30-hour ride with her grandmother. She walked into a recording studio in a garage attached to a TV repair shop, and she began to sing. It was Dolly Parton's first ever recording. It did not make her famous, but it was a first step from her humble roots in East Tennessee to international stardom. A new biography traces that journey. It's called Ain't Nobody's Fool, The Life and Times of Dolly Parton. Author Martha Ackman joins us now. Thanks for being here, Martha.
Good to be with you, Rob.
So Dolly Parton, of course, is an American icon. You know, writing a biography about her seems a little daunting. She's been written about so much. What did you want to illuminate about her life that hadn't been done in previous works about her?
What I wanted to do, I certainly wanted to cover her songwriting, her acting career, her remarkable philanthropy. But I also wanted to locate her in history and in culture. I wanted to kind of unpack her as a unique American and someone who has had a broad impact on the country.
And what did you draw on to do that? I mean, were you able to talk to Dolly or people close to her?
Yes, I was able to talk with family members, cousins, schoolmates. We reached out to Dolly and tried to secure an interview, but they did not respond. I don't think Dolly's done a full-fledged interview for a number of years now.
So let's start with Dolly's childhood. She grows up in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains in the holler, as she calls it, one of 12 children, extremely poor. How did all of that shape her?
She has always been, still is, very attuned to everything around her. It wasn't an easy road for her. Her father had a drinking problem. There were difficulties with infidelity and certainly poverty. I say something in the book about the family was a family of storytellers, and all those stories were like a funnel that came through Dolly, and I think that gave her the beginning of her songwriting career.
You know, and this part of her life inspired much of her best work. In the third grade, her mother sewed her a coat from scraps of recycled clothes. Dolly was so proud of it, she wore it to school for picture day.
In my coat of many colors, I hurried off to school just to find the others laughing and making fun of me. In my coat of many colors, my mama made for me.
That is the Dolly Parton hit Coat of Many Colors, of course. It sounds like it was just completely humiliating, as you recounted. Other kids tried to tear the coat off of her, and in her third grade photo, there's tears streaming down her face. But all of that bullying she experienced really just made her all the more determined, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I found out a lot about that incident. But that song stayed kind of within Dolly for years and years and years. And in fact, she didn't even tell her mother about the incident the day after it happened. It deeply humiliated her. But then she's on a bus one day when she was with the Porter Wagoner show, and one of the other musicians on the show saw her grab something to write on. Dolly always seems to be without paper and pencil. So she grabs whatever was near her. And she grabbed a cleaning ticket from one of Porter Wagoner's flashy suits that he wore to perform in. And she began jotting down the lyrics to the song. Others have said songs seem to come to Dolly fully formed. And it's a good thing there are scraps of paper all around because she's fast.
And Martha, this is where I want to bring up a song that Dolly wrote for Porter Wagoner and about Porter Wagoner. And this is a very famous song. And I think it brings up how, in some ways, good of a businesswoman she was right from the beginning. I love the story of when a certain king of rock and roll wants this song, and she says, no. Tell us what happened.
Dolly was pretty young when she wrote I Will Always Love You. This happened during the breakup with Porter Wagoner, where they were again in Nashville and fighting about her leaving, and she wrote the song, being able to pour out what she felt for Porter. She was very grateful for the chance that Porter gave her, but she knew she had to go. And then Colonel Tom Parker came knocking on her door. And again, Dolly's pretty young at this point. I think she's in her 20s. And he said, Elvis would like to record this song. She was ecstatic. And she said, that would be wonderful. And he said, just one thing. We have to have the publishing on it. And Dolly said, oh, I can't do that. I can't do that if it were half the publishing. She said, that's my best copyright. It was a remarkable chess move for anyone to make with Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis. Fast forward, you know, some 20 years later, Whitney Houston comes out with her version of I Will Always Love You and just blows the roof off of it. Dolly said she was driving home in her car, and then Whitney hits the big, you know, crescendo. Dolly said she was so blown away by it that she had to pull over into a Walgreens to collect herself.
That rendition of that song is incredibly powerful, as everyone knows. Now, Dolly Parton has always had such an over-the-top style, and you write about her huge hair, her tight clothes, and there's a really interesting quote from her that you include. She said that the thing that's always worked for me is the fact that I look so totally artificial, but am so totally real. What does she mean by that?
Dolly sometimes calls herself a cartoon of a woman and describes her big hair and heavy makeup and cinched waist as her get-up. Dolly said looking one way and being another gives her something to play off, that people expect her to be a kind of buffoon, to be a fool in the way she looks, until they hear her sing, until they hear her songs. So it has always worked for her. And she's toned it down over the years, but she found that it also worked for her professionally because she would go up against the expectations people had for her.
And I think what's so interesting about Dolly Parton is that she has fans from throughout the political and cultural spectrum. She has fans from the religious right. She's got a huge fan base in the LGBTQ community. How is she able to appeal to so many different people?
Dolly was raised in her grandfather's church. She knew the Bible, and one of her favorite verses was, "Judge not, lest you be judged." And she lives by that. If I had to choose one word to describe Dolly Parton as a human being, I'm not talking about her as a singer or a songwriter, I would use the word decency, that hardcore decency that respects other people and treats others with compassion and openness.
That's Martha Ackman. Her new book is called Ain't Nobody's Fool, The Life and Times of Dolly Parton. It's out December 30th. Martha, thanks.
Thank you.
bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life.
And you are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. It's been an unsettling few days in Japan. A 7.5 magnitude earthquake off the coast of the country on Monday put the nation on what's called a mega quake watch. Seismologists say there's a 1% chance of an earthquake 8.0 or higher offshore this week. That, of course, is not likely, but if it did happen, according to a report by the Japanese government, it would have the potential to produce a tsunami of up to 98 feet high, putting the lives of 200,000 people at immediate risk. So how do we keep people informed without causing a panic? We're joined now by Richard Allen, director of the Berkeley Seismology Lab in California. Welcome, Richard.
Great to be with you.
So, Richard, what is a megaquake?
So these are the truly huge earthquakes, in the case of Japan, in subduction zones, although we can have magnitude 8 earthquakes in strike slip faults here in California as well.
Richard, you just mentioned a subduction zone. For those of us who don't know what that is, tell us what that is.
Sure. So a subduction zone are around the margins of some of the oceans where you have oceanic plate diving down beneath the continental plate adjacent to it, or another oceanic plate. Because you have that vertical motion with the plate subducting, that's how you generate tsunamis. In California, we think more about strike-slip faults. And San Andreas Fault is a strike-slip fault where the two plates are moving sideways next to each other. And so you don't expect a tsunami on a strike-slip fault.
So how do officials balance informing people about what's going to happen versus causing a panic about it?
So it's important that we, the scientific community, let the public know about that, and being very clear that, yes, there's a higher probability of a megaquake this week, but it's still a low probability. And so it's a great opportunity for people to be thinking about how are they going to react? Are they ready to react when a large magnitude earthquake and a tsunami like that come? Because even if it doesn't come this week, they are going to occur in the future, and so everybody needs to be ready.
What kind of protocol has Japan put into place to prepare the population for a quake like this?
Well, there's two sets of preparations that people have to make. It's what do the institutions, what does government do, and then what do we as individuals do? So first of all, for institutions, for the government, what they've put in place is warning systems. We have to provide people with the warning, and we sort of hit the go button so people can start to take their actions. But then the second piece is what do we as individuals do? We all have to be responsible for ourselves and for the people around us. We all need to know what is it we should do when we get the earthquake warning or when we feel shaking. We should know that we need to do drop, cover, hold on. And then in the case of the tsunami, of course, it's really important to get to higher ground. If you're living in a coastal region, you need to know that you're in a tsunami hazard zone, and you need to know how far you need to evacuate in order to get out of that hazard.
Now, you're standing there in California. Obviously, California, the rest of the West Coast, is also prone to earthquakes. I'm just curious, does the U.S. have a similar system than Japan as far as these megaquake warnings?
So what we have is we have aftershock warnings. So it's actually well known in California, for example, that there, when you have an earthquake, there is a 1 in 20 chance that there will be a larger earthquake that follows it. And so we have similar kinds of information systems. They're delivered by the USGS. If you go to the USGS webpages following an earthquake, you will see graphics that explain the likelihood of aftershocks, including the possibility of a larger magnitude earthquake as well.
That is Richard Allen, director of the Berkeley Seismology Lab in California. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Happy to be with you.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:39. You're listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop and on Facebook. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's story is about getting ready for Christmas. At 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. At noon, the recorded history of jazz with Paul Kivi. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly brunch buffet tomorrow, 9 to noon. There will also be a craft and goodies sale. The Buck Lake Community Center is located 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. And Bemidji Senior Center will share information about their 2026 bus trips this Tuesday, 9:30. You do not have to be a member of the Senior Center to join these trips.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. President Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff and his son-in-law Jared Kushner are reported to be traveling to Germany for ceasefire talks with Ukraine. The Wall Street Journal says they're traveling to Berlin ahead of a summit of European leaders on Monday. Belarus has released more than 120 prisoners, including the Nobel Peace Prize laureate Alice Beliatsky. The release in exchange for sanctions relief follows negotiations with an envoy for President Trump. And international human rights groups are condemning the reported arrest of another Peace Prize laureate, Narges Mohammadi, in Iran. The Nobel Committee is calling on Iranian authorities to clarify her whereabouts. Iran has not confirmed the arrest. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Legacy Box, dedicated to preserving family memories, old tapes, films, and photos, with the goal of spreading joy of reliving the moments that matter. More at legacybox.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. It's Christmas time, and if you live in the Central Alps, you can expect a few visitors this time of year. First, St. Nicholas. And alongside that bearded inspiration for Santa Claus comes a darker figure, Krampus. Krampus has roots in late antiquity, when Roman traditions of raucous deep winter revelry feathered into emerging Christian habits. Add to that the notion of a child-eating ogre that entered European folklore in the 1500s, and if you're in the continent's mountainous areas, you weave it all into a hairy horned demon carrying cowbells and handfuls of tightly bound branches who punishes you if you've been naughty. And in Salzburg, Austria last weekend, there were a lot of naughty people, including me.
Oh, man! Ow!
Last Friday night, I took part in what's called a Krampuslauf, in English, a Krampus run. More than 200 Krampuses let loose in the city, making a racket, causing mayhem, and terrifying children. Welcome to Christmas in the Alps. The day starts here in a soccer stadium in Salzburg, where dozens of mostly large men slip into costumes made of goat and yak hair. Alexander Hütte is in charge here. He calls himself the Uber Krampus.
Groups from Bavarian, groups from everywhere in Austria, they are coming today here.
So traveling here to be a Krampus.
Is something like the Mecca of the Krampus runs.
What are the Krampus guys doing now?
Yeah, change their gloves.
Okay. Is there any drinking involved in this?
No, nothing.
I'm sure there's nothing of that sort.
Nothing.
Because the Krampus have to focus on what their job is, right?
And their job, of course, is to swarm like banshees behind the white-bearded figure of St. Nicholas and seek out people who've been naughty and to punish them. When I ask Hütter why people in this part of Europe take part in this tradition, he skips the centuries of pagan history, early Christianity, Central Europe's penchant for darkness, and he cuts straight to the chase, which is, of course, entertainment.
Ja, natürlich. Ja, die haben Angst, sehr, sehr, sehr viel Angst.
If St. Nicholas comes to town on his own, it's nice, but there's no excitement, no tension. I mean, he says, St. Nick is all well and good, but at the end of the day, people want to see something darker. They want to see Krampus. And Roy Huber is happy to oblige. He came here today from across the border in the German state of Bavaria. He says the rest of the year he feels like a civilian. But then...
When the winter comes, you have the feeling.
Yeah.
Like under the skin, you are ready to act like a Krampus.
From the neck down, Huber looks like Chewbacca. He's in a costume of long, coffee-colored yak hair. But then there's the mask.
I need to explain this mask. It's a mask of a disfigured man with one good eye.
Yeah.
And he's been, looks like he's been hit with an axe on one side of his face. And he's got a beautifully, waxed mustache
yeah.
for some reason. And then he's got two horns sticking out of his head.
That's my kind of type.
I love the mustache. I mean, for Americans who understand baseball history, it's like the Raleigh fingers of Krampus.
Hoover shoots me a quizzical look, but I assure him that the legendary American baseball closer from the 70s was, for batters at least, a major league Krampus. The next Krampus in line is Benny Zeiger, also from Bavaria, who's wearing a mask with eyeballs popping out of their sockets and small horns protruding from the top of his head in the form of a mohawk.
Do the kids sometimes get super scared?
Ja, natürlich. Ja, die haben Angst, sehr, sehr, sehr viel Angst.
Yeah, Zeiger says, they get very scared. But if you're a sensitive Krampus, it can go well. In fact, he says, our Krampus Club hosts an event called Cuddle a Krampus to ensure them that we're not scary. I quickly learned, though, that I do not qualify for this service. Zeiger reaches into a can and smears my face with tar before swatting me in the legs with a handful of birch branches.
Ow! Ow!
Yeah.
That actually hurts!
But I don't make it
hard. You didn't even do it that hard! No. Wow! That inflicted a little pain, I gotta admit. Wow! Who do you hit with that?
Zeiger tells me I mainly hit the young adults who stand around and are asking for it. Normally, Niklos Blimsleder would be one of those young adults asking for it. He's 19, but his mom tells me he's gamed the system. He's been a Krampus for 14 years.
How do you like being a Krampus?
I like it really much. It's just amazing. The costume, the mask, it's just another world when you have the mask on.
That's what your mom was telling us. She said that you were a Krampus as young as age five. Is that right?
That's when I started, yeah.
Were you scared about being a Krampus at that age?
I wasn't scared of being a Krampus, but I was scared of the Krampus. But when the first time I had the mask on, I wasn't scared anymore.
Interesting.
It went away.
So putting the Krampus mask on cured your fear of the Krampus?
Yeah, it cured my fear, yeah.
Did you look in the mirror?
I can't remember that I looked in the mirror.
It's probably a good thing.
The Krampuses get excited when city buses arrive to take them to the heart of Salzburg's Old Town. It is game time for these horned demon devils of Christmas. The bus doors swing open. Dozens of Krampuses empty into the streets of downtown Salzburg, lunging at shoppers, swatting them with switches, their cowbells a-clanging. At the front of this procession is St. Nicholas, holding a staff, handing out candy with a serene smile, and blissfully oblivious of the cacophony of blood-curdling chaos behind him. René Watziger watches the Krampuses go by, his 4.5-year-old son, Valentin, perched on his shoulders. And Valentin is terrified. He's covering his eyes with his mittens, his head is buried into his father's neck, and he's shaking.
Valentin, it's gonna be okay, buddy. How do you feel about taking him to this?
It's great. It's my childhood memory.
Yeah?
I come from Salzburg.
Okay.
And so I want him to have the same good memories for his childhood, yeah. It's one of my favorite childhood memories.
But Valentin is putting his hands on his eyes. He's so scared.
Yeah, but he's gonna look at the video.
Yeah.
And then he's going to be proud. And in kindergarten next week, he will be very proud.
The rush of Krampuses then pushes me through the old town's pedestrian district. A few of them smear black tar on my face, while a couple more hit me with their branches.
Oh, man! Ow!
But according to Sabina Gruber, who's here with her 13-year-old daughter, I am a wimp. Gruber says the Krampus run has gotten tamer over time. For example, the Krampuses now wear stickers on their backs with numbers so that people can complain about them if they feel like they've been hit too hard.
Als ich Kind war, da war das noch viel schlimmer.
When I was a child, says Sabina, it was worse. You were beaten so hard that you woke up the next day with blue welts on your legs.
These days, she says with a frown, the Krampus run is more like a petting zoo. She seems to yearn for the days when Christmas time meant a good beating to remind you to behave. And now, it's time for sports. Another head coach crashes out in college football and a stunning win in downhill skiing at the World Cup. Sports writer Howard Bryant is here. Good morning, Howard.
Rob, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Michigan's football coach, Sharon Moore, was fired for an inappropriate relationship with a staffer and then arrested earlier this week. We've seen similar scandals with head coaches elsewhere, like with Mel Tucker at Michigan State. Howard, are coaching scandals becoming more common in college football?
I don't know if they're becoming more common, but certainly they're much more prominent. I think the Krampus needs to take a trip to Ann Arbor. when you think about what
clean
is...
clean that place up.
Exactly. When you look at what has happened, not only did Sean Moore get his job because of his previous... His predecessor, the Los Angeles Chargers coach Jim Harbaugh, was let go because of recruiting violations and the infamous sign-stealing scandal, which Moore was also a part of. And now you look at what's happening here, which... It's a spectacular public fall. It's for a team that won the national championship 2 years ago. It is stunning. And then you add to that the sort of the coaching craziness going on, whether it's Lane Kiffin, but it's not, obviously that's not criminal, but it's the amount of power that these coaches have and the amount of money involved. You look at it, whether it's there, whether it's even in the professional ranks with Ime Udoka with the Boston Celtics having an inappropriate relationship with a staffer, which got him fired from the team 3 years ago. And so it's just obvious at some level that the checks and balances are a little off when it comes to the coaching, especially at the college level. Enormous amount of power, enormous amount of responsibility, and not a lot of oversight, it seems.
So let's go from college to professional football. There's a big game in Foxborough this weekend. The Bills host the Patriots. These are the top two teams in the AFC East Division. A win would basically guarantee the Patriots take the division. Howard, did you see this coming when the season started?
No, I don't think anybody saw it coming with the Patriots. I mean, and I actually think it's in both directions. I think that people, I mean, look, it's Josh Allen's turn, at least it's supposed to be. Patrick Mahomes has been the reigning champ of the AFC for a long time. Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson over in Baltimore are supposed to be the ones who take over. And yet it hasn't quite turned out that way for Buffalo. They are on the cusp. And it's funny because Kansas City's down this year. And Baltimore is not that good this year. And so you would think that Josh Allen would have a pretty clear track to the Super Bowl. But Denver's pretty good. And now they may not even win their own division because the Patriots came out of nowhere. And so huge game. I don't think it's as big a game for Buffalo. Josh Allen is tested. Buffalo is tested. But for the Patriots, what an opportunity to try to get there ahead of schedule. Pretty remarkable season for Mike Vrabel and a potential rookie MVP quarterback, Drake May.
So let's travel to the ski slopes. An amazing comeback from Lindsey Vonn this week, who won the World Cup in downhill skiing at 41 years old. She's been winning downhill ski races for more than 20 years. This one, which was in Switzerland, was especially surprising because Vonn is skiing on a reconstructed knee.
It's really incredible, and I think that when I saw that story, the first thing I thought was, one, I covered Lindsey Vonn in the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, which means she's 41, and I don't want to think about how old I am, but it's remarkable to do what they do. Anyone who's ever been to a downhill ski race, the physicality of it, of that sport, it's ridiculous. To do that on a partial knee replacement at 41 years old. Let's take a little moment for Lindsey Vonn. We talk about LeBron James and Tom Brady. How about Lindsey Vonn? Incredible.
Incredible. Sports writer Howard Bryant. Thanks, Howard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what happens when immigration agents show up to question the people working at your house? One woman in Charlotte, North Carolina, had to face that situation last month when Border Patrol agents suddenly appeared on her front lawn. NPR's Adrian Florido has her story.
There's a big pine tree in Reba Hamilton's front yard, about 10 feet tall. Each year, just before Thanksgiving, she has it strung with Christmas lights. But this year, the lights are wrapped only around the very top of the tree, just the tip.
It looks completely ridiculous, unless you know why it looks like that.
On November 15th, Hamilton was on her front porch drinking coffee while two men she'd hired to put the lights up set up their ladder and got to work. They'd just gotten started when an unmarked minivan pulled up out front.
I see the car rolling to a stop, and I see the doors already open with the guys getting out. Border Patrol is here.
Two uniformed agents with their faces covered got out of the van and approached her workers. Hamilton grabbed her phone and started filming.
Brandy, they're in our yard.
She yelled out to her husband as the agents started peppering her workers with questions in Spanish. I want to know what country you're a citizen of, the agents say. You're not answering my question. I'm a federal agent. In the video, you see the worker on the ladder freeze in place. The one on the ground slowly moves away. Neither says a word. Hamilton gets up close to record.
I wanted their faces. I wanted to be able to show them hiding their faces. They're not proud of the work they're doing.
She says she was terrified for the workers who were undocumented. Then suddenly, and without saying a word, the agents stop their questions and run back to their van and drive off. At that moment, Hamilton felt her fear turn to rage. She rushed toward the van.
Get the hell out of my yard, you...
I was so angry, and I was really surprised to hear myself bid them farewell, because I don't really cuss, but I stand by it.
DHS says its agents do not racially profile, but Hamilton says that is what it felt like. The agents came onto her property without permission, she says, ready to haul away two men because they looked Latino.
Of course, they chose them because they were brown, but I think also they chose them because they thought they were going to be a real easy target.
Once the agents were gone, her workers ran to their truck and drove off themselves.
Yeah, just go home.
Hamilton says she fully supports law enforcement, but she thinks immigration agents under Trump are terrorizing good people like her workers.
If this is happening in your yard, and while you do not know the people well, you know them well enough to know that they are well and truly screwed if this goes down, that they will maybe never see their families again. So I feel like a lot of people would have done exactly what I did.
As for the still half-decorated Christmas tree in her yard?
I thought maybe we'll just leave it like this as a symbol of what happens when ICE and Border Patrol gets involved in your world. Things don't go as planned.
And you wind up, she says, with no work getting done. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Scott Simon returns next week.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere. At betterhelp.com/public. This is NPR.
It's just before 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 in the Brainerd area and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. And 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. KAXE and KBXE are proud members of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, a network of 17 independent community radio stations across Minnesota. AMPRS does not receive funding from Minnesota Public Radio, and many of the stations of AMPRS recently lost federal funding. This loss made up as much of half as some stations' budgets, but community radio is not defeated. You can help keep AMPRS stations going strong. Donate at AMPRS.org. Looking at our weather today, we are under a cold weather advisory all day through 10 a.m. or noon tomorrow, depending on where you are. Temperatures today, 2 below to 9 below for highs, mostly sunny, chance of snow, blustery northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour. Lows tonight, 16 below to 23 below zero, and then tomorrow, partly sunny, highs near 5 above. Winds from the northwest up to 20 miles per hour, a bit warmer by Monday, highs near 20.
Let me think for a second. What do I want to start?